Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. To ask a question during the question-and-answer session later, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. Now I'd like to turn the call over to your host, Ms. Ellen McCauley. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hi, this is Ellen McCauley, and I am with the Advancing Informal STEM Learning Program, and we're going to start today by introducing two critical people to our team that you may not often see front and center, and that's Pam Brooks-Pope and Katie
Schreier.
I'm sorry, Katie Schreier. I actually realized I hadn't said your name out loud. Pam is the staff lead for the program. I think the official title is Program Specialist, and Katie is a Program Assistant. And they do a lot of the behind-the-scenes work to make sure, first of all, that all of your proposals are compliant, that they get to the right program officer, they get to reviewers, that reviewers have places to stay, that reviewers actually have proposals assigned. So they're critical to our team, but one of the things we've realized is you may not see them regularly. So we're trying to make sure you realize how important they are to what we do here at NSF. And also, when they email you, whether you're a reviewer or a PI, to respond as well, just as you would to a PO. So Pam is going to kick us off today.
Thank you, Ellen. Hello, everyone. If you have a video camera, please turn it off during the webinar. The slides from webinars 101 and 102 are now posted on the AZA webpage. Transcripts are coming. All phones have been muted during the presentation period. We would like to maintain confidentiality of all the participants. Please omit your name and institution when speaking. 15 minutes has been allotted at the end of the webinar for questions. The operator will come back online to facilitate questions. Feel free to write questions in the chat box located at the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. Questions will be copied in our chat box, and the responses will be sent to everyone. All questions will be included in the transcript of this webinar on the AZA webpage and on informalscience.org. Should you have a specific question about your proposal idea, please consider asking a program officer via email later. Welcome to the Advancing Informal STEM Learning webinar. AZO is a program within NSF's Directorate for Education and Human Resources in the Division of Research on Learning in Formal and Informal Settings. There are two program officers and two administrative staff team members participating in today's webinar. Today, we will talk about submission process, key issues, review process, what happens after I submit my proposal, project type examples, common guidelines, getting started, questions, and resources. Key things to keep in mind. The earlier that you submit your proposal, the better. You never know what issues may arise. Please give yourself at least 2 to 3 weeks to register on NSF FastLink or grants.gov. Proposals cannot be processed without the electronic signature on the cover sheet. The authorized organizational representative must electronically sign the proposal cover sheet to submit the required proposal certification. For more information, please see page 10 of the solicitation. Failure to provide the required annual, final, or project outcome reports will delay NSF review and processing of any future funding increments, as well as pending proposals for all identified PIs and co-PIs. For more information, please see page 12 of the solicitation.
One of the things that we wanted to start with at this webinar stems from questions we've gotten since the last webinar and actually probably mostly any time that we have a submission process. And that has to do with the the overarching process. What happens to proposals once they're in? How do decisions get made? So as you are all aware, NSF uses a panel process for its reviews. And currently, panels can take one of three forms. They can be in-person panels. They can be virtual panels, where none of the panelists travel physically to NSF. Or they can be a combination of the two. While the ASIL program strives to get four reviews per proposal, the minimum required by NSF is three. As many of you are aware, the proposals are discussed by panelists, and that includes individuals who have written reviews as well as those who have read the proposal but not necessarily written a review. Proposals are rated on a scale, as you saw in the previous slide, and the panel has a thorough discussion of the merits of the proposal. That discussion is summarized in a document called the panel summary, and that is then submitted along with the individual reviews to the PI of the project. Now, it's really important to understand that the outcome of the panel is advisory. It's advisory to NSF, to the NSF program officer. It's also important to understand that depending on the number of panels, number of proposals that are on a panel, those proposals with ratings less than good may not be discussed in the panel. In this case, then the PI simply receives the written reviews that were submitted for that proposal. The panel makes a recommendation as to the quality, the competitiveness of the proposal, either saying that it is not competitive, competitive, or highly competitive. Highly competitive proposals are rare. And even if something is rated highly competitive, it may or may not get funded for a number of reasons. One of those may simply be that we don't have enough funds to fund everything that's rated highly competitive. But the other has to do with other criteria that NSF program officers and the program uses in making its final selection. These include identifying gaps in the current portfolio. So there may be proposals that happen to cover content, methodology, or approaches that we currently are not supporting research on. There may be certain content or focuses from proposals on other panels, and so coming together, we have to look at the various types of things that are submitted and where we feel that we may have been under-supporting some work, as well as, you know, geographically where proposals might come from. In addition, for some proposals, we also get external additional reviews, and that comes into play in the entire process. As noted here, there are some additional things that happen once the panel process is done. All of the program officers also write independent reviews of the proposals and incorporate those comments from the panels and reviewers. There are a number of levels of approval that occur above the ASIL program, and so it can take some time for a proposal to make it through the entire process. If your proposal is one that is being recommended for funding, you may get additional questions from the program director, questions that help clarify perhaps some information, questions that may ask you to reconsider the scope of your work, and all of that is taken into consideration as the proposal moves forward in the recommending process. It's also important to understand that while programs contribute the dollars which fund the proposals, the Division of Grants and Agreements is the only entity at NSF that is actually charged with making awards. So sometimes people have asked, like, who is this other program or where's this other person coming from? And that's the Division of Grants and Agreements. And while there's a lot of work that goes into drafting and creating a highly competitive proposal, there's even more work once you get that proposal. There are sufficient documents and supports for PIs who have been awarded. Program officers, part of our role is to help support support you in the post-award management. And once you reach that stage, there's additional things that are required as you manage and implement your proposals. One of the things that's really also important to remember is the CASE website, which has a variety of resources both as you are creating your proposal, but even after it's funded, to think about where you might post information, where you might identify additional individuals or projects that you want to connect with because of the work that you're doing.
So before we move forward, I'd like to introduce Julie Johnson. She is a new program director at NSF. I think many of you may recognize Julie. She was an ISC program officer about a decade ago as well, right?
Yep.
So welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
Now, based on our webinars 101 and our last webinar 102, we've gotten a lot of good feedback in terms of providing specific examples of project types to illustrate some of the concepts that we were talking about and really help PIs figure out what they need to be struggling with. So I want to review very quickly the evaluation and external review criteria. Excuse me, I should not call that criteria. The evaluation and external review portion of the proposal, because it is the most different from previous years. We're also getting really good feedback on people understanding this. So if you have questions, make sure you put them either include them in the chat box or ask us later, because we want to make sure people are clear and that this change is a support to the field as opposed to something that confuses you. So why is there an evaluation and review process? Basically, it is part of our transition to the Common Guidelines, which I'll talk about later. And the Common Guidelines lay out very clearly why we need evaluation and external review. First, it is to ensure projects get appropriate and rigorous input throughout the life of the project, which is good practice. And so whether it is an advisory board or a internal evaluator doing formative evaluation, the whole point of evaluation and external review is to make sure projects get appropriate, rigorous input throughout the life of the project so that the project is better for it. Second, accountability. We are in an era of accountability, and so having either an external evaluator or an advisory board, some method that is particular to your project that answers the questions, did you end up doing what you said you would do, and what is the quality of what you did? Finally, you know, with AZL, all projects must have a knowledge-building component, and that can be research or evaluation, and that can happen through the evaluation external review. Before we get the question, what is the difference between research and evaluation? I'll go through it. We've done it in each webinar. There really aren't clear definitions of research and evaluation in our field, and as NSF, we are not looking to dictate definitions. We use the words research and evaluation because different people in our field resonate with those words, and we want to be inclusive. We also know that evaluators use a lot of research methods, and researchers draw on evaluation. So we're not trying to differentiate or set down harsh guidelines or boundaries. What we're trying to do is help PIs, principal investigators, design projects that build knowledge in ways that make the most sense to the project so we can advance the field collectively. That's the goal. So there isn't a definition of research versus evaluation. So let's go on to the examples. One other thing. How did we pick these examples? We wanted to illustrate some of the topics and some of the questions that came up in Webinar 101, but I do need to state these are examples, not exemplars. All of the examples that we're showing have been funded, so they went through the peer review process and were funded. This does not mean they are the end-all, be-all. And, in fact, we don't include enough information in these slides to justify why they would be an exemplar. What we do is we include information so you think about the different issues these PIs struggled with and that you may need to struggle with in order to write a highly competitive proposal. If there's any questions about that, please let us know. So let's start with pathways. Again, pathways are exploratory studies or feasibility studies, and they should lead to other proposals that advance other types of work. Okay, so this example, developing a citizen science program model to engage underrepresented minority groups, I understand you will not be able to read this word for word. That's not the point. The reason we have all those words is so later you can go back and refer to them. The whole point of this example is to bring out that this could have been, if it were at a larger scale, an innovations and development project. But what this group did was they said, we've reviewed the literature and practice, and basically there's six components that we see that likely make for a strong citizen science project that would be effective in engaging underrepresented youth in citizen science and STEM. And their argument is citizen science is typically not effective, or we don't have effective models for engaging underrepresented youth, and that we don't understand when a project works well with underrepresented youth, how it works. So they're doing a small-scale exploratory study about the components of the model. And they've got dissemination, they've got a project design, et cetera. So their knowledge building is, how do these components work? Should we consider all these components? And then their next step would be to modify the model or to propose probably an innovations and development proposal. So that's one example.
A second example of the Pathways projects is this one, the Apprenticeships in Sustainability Science and Engineering Design. And the crux of this particular Pathways project is to understand how a particular model of apprenticeship that's used with undergraduates might be applicable for use with high school students. This project is being conducted as a collaboration amongst a number of organizations, including museums, vocational training centers, municipal departments, and community organizations. In the Pathways process, they are actually conducting a feasibility study, and they hope that that will help contribute to their understanding of how digital storytelling can be used to promote STEM learning. So that's one piece, digital storytelling. But the other is also to understand the use of the apprenticeship model and explore it more fully to understand where it may be beneficial for work with high school students. In terms of the project oversight, this particular Pathways project is employing a steering committee approach, so individuals from their various collaborative partners come together to form the oversight committee for this work. And in terms of external oversight and review, there's an advisory board that's made up of members with various expertise that lend different facets to the process, and that they are also looking at both internal and external evaluation expertise to help them better understand and help them monitor what they're doing in this project. The outcome for this would be their goal is also to do a larger scale project, but first really needing to understand this notion of apprenticeship models and how it might work with the new population.
Recognizing it may not work.
And recognizing it may not work. And actually, that's a really important part for people to understand, which is that we want to fund really good, rigorous work. And sometimes that work tells us things that actually doesn't work. And that's really important for us to know, because we'd like to tell other people, yeah, don't do that, because it doesn't work. So while, you know, we want people to feel successful, success might mean finding out that something doesn't work.
And one of the questions we get, well, what happens if this isn't successful? Well, if you learn something, again, this is a knowledge-building program. If we learn something for the field, that counts. What we want to do is build arguments or build projects that are most likely to inform the field. So let's move to research and service to practice. You'll see that we provide two examples per, except for workshops. We provide one for workshops. So research and service to practice, this focuses on providing an evidence base for practice. The primary focus is on research questions. Now, a couple of questions that we've gotten about research and service to practice as opposed to on the continuum with innovations and development, a lot of it has to do with how you frame it. So the examples you're going to see here, in some cases, you could make a case that these should be innovations for development. And again, these proposals were written for a different solicitation, so we as program officers are using them to highlight the issues that you may want to think about as you write the proposal.
So in this project, DEVISE, which as you can see is about developing, validating, and implementing standardized evaluation instruments. If we think about the category of research and service to practice, one of the questions that's really critical for you to address should you be submitting this type of proposal is, what's the practice that you're doing research in support of? In this case, this is evaluation practice. And it coalesces around many years of work doing citizen science projects and an understanding that each of these projects and each of these many efforts that occur across the country are using different kinds of tools to understand how they're successful. This group determined that there would be time well spent to see what was common across those various instruments and to perhaps validate some, maybe tweak and recreate others, that then could go back in service to all of the people who do evaluation for these kinds of programs. So it's, the knowledge building really is trying to fill a gap in terms of process and procedures, in terms of tools that are used by evaluators in their practice.
So a second example of research and service to practice is a design-based research study. And the question that they're really looking at is, how can you make making activities attractive to underrepresented audiences and therefore engage underrepresented audiences, particularly families in STEM? So it's a museum, and this museum is taking a particular theoretical approach that co-creation, the co-design and implementation of projects that are relevant to local families is likely to be a successful approach. So they've got a theoretical perspective, and then they've got a methodology, a design-based research study that is going to investigate the questions that they have. So there's a project design that has three phases of research, and then there's evaluation and external review. In each case, there's evaluation and external review. We're just highlighting them differently in different projects. In this case, there is an evaluator who serves as an external check of quality for accountability. There are internal evaluators who work with the research team all along the way, and there are research advisors in different areas that will be called on during the different three phases of research. So now we're going to move to innovations and development. And innovations and development, it builds knowledge through developing innovative projects. So again, it's part of the knowledge building of the AZL program. And it also invests in things. Now, research and service to practice also can invest in tools and exhibits, films, programs, etc. Innovations and development most likely spend more money, time, and energy in this direction. But again, it's a continuum, and the whole point is for you to make a case for what you're doing, why it's important, and why you're spending money in this way. We want to also highlight that an explicit theory and logic model, a theory of action, is important. Why do you think doing what you're doing is going to make a difference? How do the components of your project work together to address the need or the question that you have?
So this first innovations and development project focuses on alternate reality games. Part of the knowledge generation aspect of this project and the case that these proposers made was that alternate reality games, here using the acronym ARG, are typically used as marketing tools. And so if there are individuals on the line who participate in large-scale games, or their children or others do, When the movie Dark Knight came out, there was an alternate reality game that was promoted along with the movie. At any rate, these particular researchers want to understand some of the theoretical connections between this type of reality gaming and the practical applications that might be used as learning tools in other settings. And so they are interested in doing some original research around this particular platform to understand what are affordances, what are supports for learning. Their design includes open and ended alternate reality games, and they're really looking at the relative strengths and weaknesses of approaches for engaging teens in scientific inquiry. I think that something else that probably would be important to know about this particular example is that there are both set of research questions for the foundational research, as well as an evaluation methodology which helps them to understand some gap analysis information between the way that ARGs are currently used and how they think they might be used, as well as some formative work that will be done to repurpose elements of alternate reality games for the purposes of studying with this new population.
So one of the questions, Julie, that we've gotten several times since Webinar 101 is, does NSF really fund the development of a game or an exhibit or a movie?
Well, what I would say is what we're funding is research and evaluation about the use of those tools. And so to the extent that you need to create something in order to be able to use it to study it, then yes, we support it. Unfortunately, we no longer just support implementation projects like we used to. That just is not the purview of NSF anymore. So while we can fund games and exhibitions and projects, they are only funded to the extent that they're absolutely critical for you to investigate the research and or evaluation questions.
Thank you. So another example of innovations and development is Designing Our World, a community envisioning girls as engineers. So this project was intentionally chosen because it repurposes and reimagines various different components that already exist, informal STEM learning components that already exist. The team is leveraging an exhibit, girls' activity groups, and social media. And what they're interested in understanding is how to increase interest and understand the identity development of girls with respect to engineering. They're doing it in a variety of different ways. They connect with adult stakeholders. They work with community-based groups. And then they leverage these existing exhibitions, activities, and social media in a new way to understand engineering-related identities. So what is innovative in terms of this project? It's putting things together in a new way to study identity development, and it's modifying some of the components. So it's looking at components, putting them together. We often get a question of, do I have to create something new? No, you don't. You don't have to. It's what does your question, what do you want to learn, ask of you? What do you need to do to make that happen? So in terms of evaluation and external review, there are external evaluators as well as research oversight. The external evaluator may be able to do both depending on the expertise of the evaluator. And then again, there's advisors for various parts of the project. In terms of their management plan, they have a very diverse team. And going back to Webinar 101, we talk about the PI teams really need to demonstrate that they have expertise in both the practice and research and evaluation. Now, one thing that we do need to clarify is, yes, research and evaluation are practices. So what we really mean by practice is the doing of informal science learning, or whether it's an exhibit developer, whether it is an educator or a youth educator, there's the practice of informal science is very broad, and yes, it includes research and development. So our intention wasn't to box or exclude, but actually to better articulate and include, saying the people who are on the ground connecting with the audience as well as the people who are helping the team generate knowledge, those expertise are both needed and need to be demonstrated as critical and included from the very beginning in the proposal. So now let's move to broad implementation. This project type expands models, technologies, assessments, and it expands its reach either age, gender, geography, depends on the project. And the critical piece, and this is where you need to think really hard if you have a broad implementation project or not, do you have evidence that demonstrates the success or strength of your current project in its current scope? If you don't have evidence that demonstrates its strength, then it is inappropriate for you to move to a broad implementation project.
And therefore, as our first example, we're using TechBridge, which has actually been around, I believe, in Oakland, California, since the early 2000s. It's a multifaceted project that involves communities and has reached over 2,000 girls in Oakland and over 4,000 girls locally in the Oakland, California area through after-school programs, and about 15,000 girls through a national partnership with the Girl Scouts. It has also had a component that helps to train and support 8,000 role models, teachers, and families who are engaged in building supportive networks for girls. TechBridge has been doing research and evaluation on their program to understand what works and what doesn't work. And so based on that, they submitted a broadening participation project, and in this, they want to understand how to move this project into more communities and with slightly different populations. So in this instantiation, they're really wanting to understand how to connect with and support Hispanic, African American, and other English language learner populations, so girls from those populations. They also want to look at further building the capacity for STEM programming and sustainability in the rollout. So they've identified a subset of cities that will be participating with multiple sites, multiple school and organizational sites. And their research in this particular part of the study is looking at the different methods of career exploration and role model interactions with girls as co-creators. So what does it mean to have a variety of community-engaged role models interacting with girls, and how does that impact the career development choices that girls might make?
And our second example for broad implementation is Peep's World, El Mundo de Peep. And this is a television series for early learners. And the key here is that the original award was well documented that young children are more likely to ask a question for exploration or basically guide their own exploration if they've watched Peep's World as opposed to if they hadn't watched Peep's World. So they had some evidence. Now, a question that we get a lot is, does it have to be evidence from a prior NSF award? No, it does not have to be evidence from a prior NSF award. It needs to be evidence from prior work. In this case, it was evidence from a prior NSF award. And so the goal of this particular project is to broaden implementation, to expand its reach through a digital web, doing more work in English, but also adding Spanish. So targeting Spanish-speaking youth, particularly preschoolers, and also their caregivers as well as parents. So it's expanding the reach of something that has worked well, that is documented to work well, and to engage more youth in the process. Now, one of the main components of many media projects is formative evaluation. And so part of the work here that they really value and they say will be critical to the successful implementation or the broader implementation, broad implementation of this project is doing formative evaluation. There have been some questions. Is formative evaluation still valued? And absolutely it's still valued. It's part of that rigorous, appropriate, ongoing input. But again, depending on the project, depends on if you specifically want formative evaluation. Now, well, our last project type is conferences, symposiums, and symposia and workshops. Again, there is a change. If you are asking for less than $50,000, you may request that at any time. Over $50,000 is due on the due date for with the rest of the solicitation, which is January 15th. This project, 21st Century Learning in Natural History Settings, is a conference. And this project in particular was chosen because it highlights a real trend in what NSF funds, and that is if you have a conference or a workshop or symposia, it typically isn't a one-off conference, that there are pre-conference or pre-workshop activities. There is the conference itself, and then there are post-conference activities, some kind of product, a learning product that can be shared with the community. So gone are the days where you get a bunch of people together, they talk, and that's it. This particular conference had pre-workshop online asynchronous discussions about five different topics of interest to the community. At the meeting, there were a bunch of different groups, breakout groups that worked on different issues, and then there was a white paper that came out of that, or a white paper is to come out of that, and it also included a publication and curator. Another thing that was interesting about this project is the advisory board. The advisory board included scientists, educators, exhibition people, learning researchers, et cetera, as well as an external evaluator. The advisory board was extremely active during the conference. The other interesting thing about this conference is those who attended from an institution were asked to bring someone from the research side as well as someone from the education side. So it was looking for institutions to build teams and then share the work of those teams. So it wasn't just the educators who were involved. This workshop, also highlights the fact that we have, as target audiences for AZL, public audiences and professional audiences. And the professional audiences can be a target audience for any of the project types, and it is also allowable for professional audiences and public audiences to be the target audience. So you don't have to have one or the other. For some projects, it makes sense to have some components geared toward the professional audience and some components geared toward the public audience. So, Julie, would you mind answering a couple of questions that we've gotten through chat while I get a drink of water?
Not a problem. So one of the questions we've gotten, and I hope I answer it in the way that it was intended, says, does a PI receive an ad hoc review like the panelist review? So as I mentioned, that sometimes we get additional ad hoc reviews, for example, if there's a particular content area that a proposal has that is so unusual that we need to identify another expert to look at it. The panelists will receive the reviews, all of the reviews that are written. And actually, from the panelists' point of view, you won't know which ones were reviewed by people that were sitting in the panel versus people that were somewhere else and sent us a review. So any review that is written that gives feedback to you about your proposal, you do receive it. The second question, which is one that I'm sure many people are wondering, well, if NSF isn't funding implementation, who is? So I don't have a succinct answer to your question, to the person who proposed that question. I would suggest, though, that perhaps more local and regional foundations are still supporting implementation-only proposals. Again, I want to clarify that it's not that NSF won't do any implementation. Obviously, we have a category called broad implementation. The issue is that NSF funds research and evaluation. So that has to be an equally strong point and focus of any implementation kind of work. So you may want to explore local and regional funders. I believe that the Institute of Museum and Library Services also still has some programs that support implementation-only types of projects, and you'd have to review their guidelines to see what their criteria are. But thank you for those questions.
Any others? Yes, but I'll continue with the common guidelines. So one of the things that we have talked about or mentioned many times is the common guidelines for educational research and development. And one of the questions is, why are we bringing this up now if our current solicitation is not perfectly aligned with the common guidelines? Basically, we need common guidelines. So I'm going to answer that question, but I'm going to do it by talking about the common guidelines. We need common guidelines because it is viewed at the federal level that the American education system needs stronger evidence produced at a faster pace to make greater change. And so to do that with more constrained federal resources, the Department of Education and NSF, the Education Human Resource Directorate, got together and really looked at how we fund things, the language we use, and tried to come up with a vocabulary and a set of research questions that are consistent across the two agencies. Now, what do common guidelines mean? Basically, there are broad types of research and development, and what the common guidelines do is articulate the purposes, justifications, and the contributions of the various types of research and what would be expected in a proposal. The implications for us as agencies is that it informs decision-making. It allows us to analyze our awards and our portfolios, and it identifies areas of educational research and development that need additional resources or emphasis. So if we can look across the two agencies, we can do a better job of writing solicitations and determining what can be funded. Most importantly, though, I think, is that it helps ensure agencies fund robust research and development efforts, which leads directly to what is the implications for practitioners and peer reviewers. These guidelines, the common guidelines for educational research and development, provide guidance with respect to what high-quality research design looks like. It helps the field, or the goal is to help the field develop a better understanding of the stage of educational research, that we're using the same language and we understand what each other's talking about, and that we best address, we understand what each kind of project type would be expected to produce, what's reasonable, that every project isn't expected to solve all the problems of the world. That we have reasonable expectations. And in addition, the guidelines can help conceptualize and communicate the R&D in terms of the broader evidence-building agenda. So what have we done this round with the AGLE solicitation? Is the AGLE solicitation 100% aligned with the common guidelines? Not yet. We have, in the project narrative, included several labels that we want people to use, and we've included sample questions. Now, we've gotten a couple questions. Do you need to answer every question under each label? While you do need to include each label, you do not have to answer all the questions. Basically, those questions come from the common guidelines, and they're part of our attempt to transition the informal science education field into this kind of language and this kind of structure. It's also important for AGLE, and we would argue the informal science education field, because we're receiving proposals that, while they may have fantastic ideas, don't make the case, make an argument for why they are important, describe their methods well enough. So part of being pretty specific, very specific, in terms of the categories, the information we want you to include, is to help build the rigor of all the proposals that we're receiving. Now, some of you are very experienced PIs,
you may be including all this information already. Again, we're not asking you to go question by question. We're asking you to include each label and consider the questions underneath to make sure that you're making a strong case of why the work you're doing is important to the field and should be invested in at the federal level. We'll get into the project types later, after this round of proposals are submitted. However, there are a couple of things that we want to bring to your attention. And one, the center box. The whole goal is knowledge and evidence resources, building a stronger understanding of informal science education or education writ large, how different types of education work together. And that happens in three ways, or at least in the common guidelines, it's articulated in three ways. And you'll notice that this is not linear. And one of the things that we want to start with from the very beginning, this is not a linear process. You can go from A to B to C to B to A. As you are on your career trajectory, answering questions and investigating topics of interest to you and your institution. So the overarching categories of project types are building core or foundational knowledge, design and development projects, and implementation or impact evaluations or impact studies and research. So under core knowledge, there's foundational research, early stage, and exploratory research. Design and development projects, I think that's pretty clear. And then impact studies, there's three kinds that I don't think in informal science we've differentiated between them: efficacy studies, effectiveness studies, and scale-up studies. Now, again, is the goal for you to master these by January 14th or 15th when the proposals are due? No. The goal right now is to really introduce the content, what you need to make a good case, and we've already included that in the solicitation, and then begin to transition the field into these project types that we will expect to play a larger role in AZL as in the rest of education and human resources at the National Science Foundation. Do you have any additional comments to make on this, Julie?
Well, I would just say, you know, again, putting together a strong, rigorous proposal is no walk in the park. And so while it may be onerous to think about looking at yet another set of resources, you know, we still get a couple of questions about, am I doing innovations in development or am I doing broadening and implementation? There may be something to look at here in how impact evaluations are described, for example, that would help you better understand the kind of evidence you've already collected that would support whether or not you're doing a broader implementation project, for example, or whether or not there's some exploratory work that you might need to do, which might then lend yourself to saying, well, this might be more of an innovations and development type project. So I would say the extent to which people might want to look at that document and look at these differentiations may actually help them think more critically about their current work.
So you just used the word exploratory with innovations and development, and I know we'll get questions on that, so we might as well fix it now.
Okay.
So,
I'm the novice, so fix it.
So exploratory tends to be more pathways. I think what Julie was talking about, differentiating innovations and development, and she's far from a novice, innovations and development and broad implementation. Broad implementation is if you have something, a model or a tool that works and you want to expand its reach, try it with someone new. This is when it gets difficult because in the previous AZL and ISE language, we would say innovations and development takes something to scale. Now, in the Common Guidelines language, scale means something completely different. So I'll try to talk about it this way. If you're exploring a concept on a really small scale, you're exploring it, that's pathway. If you want to try it out with a normal target audience, whatever normal means, because normal for giant screen is going to be really different for normal for using community, okay? So you try it out, that's innovations and development. If you understand how something works in a normal situation, and you want to try and see if it works in some other situation or a variation of that situation, that would be broad implementation. If you don't feel like you've tried something and you really understand it pretty well, you're probably not ready for broad implementation.
I think that works fine.
All right.
Okay.
So, and again, the goal isn't to get too hung up on the guidelines, but we also don't want it to be a year or two from now and the field not be familiar and comfortable with them. So we're starting. A couple of quick questions that we get in terms of ASL and the guidelines. Are any research methodologies precluded or privileged? No. Qualitative, quantitative, mixed methods, however you want to slice and dice. The point here is that we're doing innovative, knowledge-building work that is good for our communities. What should I know and do now about the common guidelines? Get to know them. You actually will get to know them through doing your project description, which is in the solicitation pages 7 through 9, and talk about the common guidelines with your colleagues. Become familiar with the language. We're finishing up the webinar right now before we take your questions. Want to put a plug in for informalscience.org. The resources there that have been developed by NSF are compiled at informalscience.org. There is an NSF ASL section. There's an expanded ability to look up and see what has been published in the informal science education arena, as well as project reports and evaluations that you may find interesting. Again, it's important to review the literature and practice that's currently going on, no matter what your proposal is about. You're being reviewed by your peers. If you think that your peers don't know what's going on in the field, you're mistaken. So you might as well review and make a good case for why you're adding something new or different or a better understanding of what works, how it works, and make that case up front.
The other thing that is really important, especially for, PIs, you might want to see what we've currently funded in this program. Again, understanding that some of those items are funded under previous solicitations, you can still see what some of the groundwork has been done and where it might help you create your argument for why you need to do your work, because perhaps you see some stuff that hasn't been funded. The other is the Grant Proposal Guide, which is a very, very useful and important document. And you will also find information about the internal review board process that you will need to undergo should your project be something that's recommended for funding. Finally, as I believe Pam said at the beginning, submit early, because that's important. Think about grammar and think about punctuation. And sometimes that's the thing that separates the really good proposal from the most excellent. You're presenting a professional self, and so you want to present yourself and your organization and your project in the best light possible. It makes it very difficult for reviewers to get through a document that has a lot of errors in it. So really think consciously about that. Talking to a program officer, either in person or via email, is always an option for you. And the email address that you see posted there, drlaisl@nsf.gov, is what you should use.
Now, we've had a couple of people recently submit the same questions or examples to multiple program officers. And all I can say is program officers do talk to one another. We think our time is valuable because we get a lot of questions from people, so we would ask, if you have a question or want input, please contact one program officer, or if you're going to contact more than one of us, copy us together. But preferably use drlaisl.nsf.gov. So because we've been answering questions along the way that have been coming on the web, we're willing to stay for another 15, 20 minutes as needed. Kind of surprising to look at the time. Fran, if there are questions from the group, we'll take them now. Otherwise, Julie and I will continue to answer questions. We've got quite a number of questions that have come off the chat.
So far, none on the telephone lines, but as a reminder, please press star then one if you do have a question. Thank you very much.
Okay. So one question here is, I'm assuming the question is, my program has 2 to 3 years of evidence and is looking for expansion. Should I submit to innovations and development or broad implementation? So I think that we have tried to answer that question previously. And so I guess if I were talking to you on the phone, the person who submitted this, my first question would be, what's your question? What are you trying to investigate? Is there an element that you feel that you don't understand fully, that you want to explore in for more detail, then you might be looking at an innovations in development project? Is your evidence for what works, how it works, and what context it works thorough and complete, and now your question is, so will this work with another population? So you want to broaden your implementation and understand how your project works in a new setting. But the first question I would ask you is, what's your question? And that will guide you in thinking about which avenue to take.
Fran, do we have questions from the floor?
No, we do not. Thank you.
So there's a question. How do I, as a young PI without funding, get a funding record? That's a fantastic question. In terms of our portfolio, we fund new PIs of any age every year. You don't have to have a funding record to get funding. What you need is a great idea and a great team and a great method to investigate that great idea. So there is the part of the application, well, the proposal that asks to talk about prior funding. That is important if you've had prior funding. If you haven't had prior funding, that is not held against you. In other words, if you've had prior funding, you're asked to document that you've done what you said you would do and that there have been impacts or that you've learned something or that you've developed something. But if you haven't had prior funding, that's okay. Other things you may want to consider, you may not need to be, you don't need to be the PI the first time around. There are first-time PIs all the time, but you may want to be a senior team person. You may want to be a co-PI. There's ways to build your credibility, but also build your experience. You don't have to be the lead. But again, there's no reason why you shouldn't try to be the lead if that makes the most sense. Again, you're looking at making your strongest team and the strongest case for your proposal. Do you have any other additions or questions?
I do have another question. What percent of proposals will be funded? A ballpark is that we have the success rate in this last round is roughly 8%. So it is likely that we will be somewhere in that ballpark in terms of an 8% return. In terms of the specific subcategories of what gets funded, that's something that we can't identify because we don't know what's been submitted. By that, I mean, if no one submits any Pathways projects, then there will be zero Pathways project funded. But it's really hard up front to say to you, to say to this person, what percentage of projects, what percentage of the categories. We've given you some guidelines in the solicitation that says, here's what we think based on previous track record. But again, each instantiation of these rounds is really new, and we never know what you guys will send to us.
The next question, if resubmitting, should I reference what happened and the changes that I've made? Well, we really don't have data on whether that makes a difference or not. Some people do, some people don't. The program officers know if this is a resubmission or not because we have access to the databases, but the panel does not, so it's your choice. I've heard cases where people who have gotten highly competitive have indicated they've gotten highly competitive, but they were at, but the panel saw weaknesses of X, Y, Z, and they've addressed that. That's one strategy. Do you have to do that? No. So we don't have a recommendation. We don't have data to indicate what is most helpful. It is one strategy. I don't know what else to say on that one.
Yeah, that one's a hard one, and that one's going to have to be your call and how you want to tell your story. I think what's most important is to understand that there's a group of individuals who need to understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, why you've made the decisions that you've made, why you've assembled the group that you've assembled, and what you see as critical and necessary to the work that you're trying to propose. The device you use to do that is really up to you. I probably would shy away from the litany of, well, they told me this, so I'm going to do this. As some of you who have been multiple-time submitters know, we don't have standing panels where it's the same group of people looking at your proposal the next time, so you really are dealing with a new audience. So question is, how many collaborators is too many or too few? Again, not necessarily a question that we can answer because we don't know the scope of your project. What will be important for you to articulate is why the collaborators you have are necessary to the conduct of your project, how they are involved, you know, in terms of the length of time, et cetera, and what they bring to the project. The judgment of too many or too few typically happens because reviewers don't understand why you've made the decisions that you've made. You know, we've talked about a couple of projects here as examples that have quite a number of collaborators, but that makes sense for the project. So it really has to do with what makes sense for you.
Fran, do we have any questions?
We do, actually. Karen Hoffman, your line is open now.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. So we're submitting an innovations and development proposal, and my question is about an IRB. We were talking about who's responsible for the IRB. Is it the lead organization? Is it the evaluator? Is it the researcher? Is it all three?
So the everything about the proposal is the responsibility of the PI. If it's a collaborative proposal, then the two different or the multiple PIs, but it is the lead organization that is responsible for all parts of the proposal. And as you all know, if you've read the solicitation or attended webinars 101, NSF will not make an award now if IRB has not been settled. That may be exempt. In the case of conferences and workshops, it may be not applicable, or it may be a full IRB. But be aware that NSF does not make awards unless the IRB situation has been settled. That said, you do not have to have IRB settled when you're submitting the proposal. Once you start getting questions from a program officer, start moving quickly or start the process beforehand.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Fran?
Yes?
Please don't use last names.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, conference question. Do we have to decide where to hold it before submitting the proposal? I would say to you, you ought to have a good idea of where this is going to occur, because that is one of the considerations that a reviewer and review panel makes in determining whether or not they feel sufficient work has occurred and the sufficient things are in place for this conference to take place. We all recognize that trying to get venues for these kinds of events can occur as far out as a year, so it's not unreasonable to assume that you have made some connections and have some tentative things in place for a proposal that you are submitting. So you do want to at least have 90% surety of where it's going to occur, but we recognize that you may not make the final commitments until you know whether or not the project is funded.
Do we have more questions, Fran?
Please press star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. I show no questions at this time.
Okay, so I've got a couple more. May I have more information on learning outcomes and the framework? So in 2008, a document came out by Friedman et al. It is referenced in the reference section of the solicitation that outlines five impacts that that we encourage you to think about or use. Now, one of those impacts is the category other. So since 2008, several other documents, all of which or many of which are included in the solicitation in the reference section, have begun to explore impacts, categories of learning that are becoming more common across the field. So whether it's persistence or identity, behavior, skills, those documents are listed in the solicitation. For example, the NRC document, Learning Sciences and Informal Environments, another NRC document, 21st Century Learning Skills, the Friedman et al. Again, we define learning as a field. We define it very broadly. And these documents are encouraging us as a field to use common languages, common language and common conceptions. So we don't have specific learning outcomes. We encourage you to use the Friedman et al. And other documents that are coming out focused on informal science education. That said, we do define learning broadly, and if there is a way to define learning outcomes that you think is important, and you can make a case for it, great. Another question is, can evaluation be done by in-house staff? So I would ask that you go back to the slides in the solicitation about, are you getting external, some kind of external input in terms of, or evaluation in terms of the quality and the, did you do what you say you were going to do, and what's the quality of what you did? Now, we have had cases where universities or larger institutions or departmentalized institutions have made a case that there is an external individual within or an external group within the institution and have been able to document that that is the case and that makes sense. So, again, I feel like we say the same thing over and over. There aren't strict guidelines. You are creating a project that you want to do and that you think meets the guidelines that NSF ASL has, and you make a case for that. Fran, do we have additional questions?
I show no questions.
All right. One final one that I have here is, when are panels? And I know that somewhere on the NSF website there's a wonderful schematic of the proposal review process that from the moment a proposal comes in until the proposal decision is made. Typically, panels occur somewhere 6 to 12 weeks after the submission date. So sometime in the spring is when our panels will be.
A question. Do I need IRB for evaluation only? So NSF requires that you either receive a full evaluation of your IRB or it's considered exempt in all cases except workshops, proposals, et cetera. However, with workshops, proposals, et cetera, if you have a component that has a lot of evaluation, et cetera, you will also have to have some kind of IRB review. So, yes, you need IRB. You need some kind of IRB review. It may be that you're considered exempt. And again, I would ask that you go to the informalscience.org website. There has been a series of blog posts that really tries to unpack IRB and provide some insight, not guidance, but some insight from previous PIs and researchers, evaluators who deal with IRBs and this kind of thing all the time. There's one blog post that's expected in the next couple weeks, but that's on informalscience.org. Search on IRB. Look at, I think it's either called blogs or I think it's perspectives. How are we doing, Fran? Questions?
I show no questions.
Wow, this has been a heavy chat group as opposed to the last one, which was question, question, question.
Okay. So we have a couple more?
I think we've hit all of those. The last question I see, does a project need to identify a specific STEM area? I would say read the solicitation. Absolutely.
All right. I think that is it then for what we have.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Julie.
Not a problem.
Thank you, Fran.
And thank you all who participated in the webinar. We hope that you have a more full understanding of things. Perhaps you may have new questions, and that's always a good thing as well. And please don't forget to use the email address on the screen to send us questions. And finally, if you are thinking about, while you may not be a reviewer if you are submitting during this competition, NSF has a number of programs for which we are always looking for expert reviews. If you would like to be a reviewer, be considered for a review for this program or for another program, again, you can submit your information to that email address, indicating in the subject line that you would like to be considered for a future reviewer.
And include the areas, your areas of expertise, and some kind of CV or resume. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Today's conference has ended. All participants may disconnect at this time.